Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm your host, Nicole DiMartino, and of course, I am here with Jim Lang, CPA and attorney and best-selling author of Retire Secure and his new book, The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again, which is now available on Amazon.com. Tonight, we're getting right into it. We're talking tonight about safe withdrawal rates, and simply put, that means how much can you safely spend out of your retirement plan and not run out of money? This is a question Jim gets all of the time. We felt that it was a good time to talk about this on the show. It's crucial to determine this number correctly, because if you don't, you could be in some big trouble. Tonight's show is live. Studio line is 412-333-9385. Again, that number is 412-333-9385, and the lines are open right now. So before I turn it over to Jim, I want to introduce everyone to our guest tonight, who's going to help us answer that question, how much you can spend without running out of money. We are very fortunate to have Bill Bingen, certified financial planner and author of Conserving Client Portfolios During Retirement, with us. He's also written several other financial articles, which have appeared in Financial Planning Magazine, the Journal of Financial Planning, and the Wall Street Journal. Bill received his BS from MIT. He's a CFP, certified financial planner, and he has his master's in financial planning. He's a widely regarded safe withdrawal rate expert, and I believe he's checking in from California. Bill, are you there?
I certainly am.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Before we get into this substance, I just thought I would mention how I invited Bill to come on to the radio show. In the 90s, there was an article on the safe withdrawal rates in the Journal of Financial Planning. And I was so impressed with the article that I literally tore it out of the magazine, and I had kept it for years and referred back to it on numerous occasions. And then when I decided to do a show on the safe withdrawal rate, I did an independent examination. I went into Google and other sources, and I was looking for who was writing in this field in an authoritative way. And guess what? It was the same guy. Bill Bingen. So, Bill, I very much appreciate you being willing to come on the show tonight. So welcome.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, why don't we get right into it? And by the way, I will also say that one of the benefits for me, in terms of professional development of doing this show, is I usually do read the book of the guests, and I have read your book, and I learned a lot. So I will thank you there. Could you explain to our audience the difference between the safe withdrawal rate and the expected rate of return over time?
Sure. I know when I first started doing this research, people used to calculate, you know, how much they could take out of their retirement portfolios without running out of money. They used to say, well, you know, I can earn 7 or 8% a year, and therefore I should be able to take out 7 or 8% a year. And therefore, my portfolio will sustain me for the rest of my life. Well, of course, there's two big things they forgot. They forgot, first of all, that there is inflation. Their withdrawal is going to have to go on inflation. You have to take that into account. And then you have to take into account that every once in a while we run into a big problem in the stock market. We did in 2008, where you have huge negative returns, and they can just decimate your portfolio for a period of time. So what I went about to seek was taking all those factors into account. What is the highest rate of return that you could take out safely without running out of money, let's say, for 30 or 35 years? And that's where I came up with that 4 to 4.5% of your portfolio value figure.
All right. And can you define safely for our audience?
Yeah. Well, you know, safe is relative. There are no guarantees in investing or anything else. But essentially, I look back over the last 80 years or so, going back to the Great Depression, and I created imaginary investors, retired at various dates, and gave them their investment returns as they're actually earned at actual rates of inflation. And I determined that the 4 or 4.5% worked in every single case, that all those folks lasted for at least 30 years, their portfolio sustained them. So that's what safe means.
All right, so basically you're saying a financial reconstruction of going back based on historical data, in every single scenario, you came up with a, let's say, 4 or 4.5% rate, and nobody ran out of money. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right.
All right. So in your book, you call, and I guess what we're talking about is the safe withdrawal rate. Is the safe withdrawal rate the same as safe max?
Yes. They're interchangeable, yeah.
Okay. All right. So safe max is the name that you give in your book for what you consider, again, you make a point, no guarantees, you're not guaranteeing the future. So with that, let's start for that 30-year period. You said between 4 and 4.5%, and let's say you have $1 million, that would mean that you could either take out $40,000 or $45,000 from the portfolio and have that money last 40 years. Have that money last for 30 years, and you could take out, let's say if it's 44%, you could take out $40,000, or if it's 4.5%, it's $45,000. Do you want to distinguish between 4 and 4.5%, or do you think that that's a reasonable enough relevant range?
I think the 4.5% is a good figure to use. That's when I updated my research and included, you know, other types of investments. It went up to 4.5%. I think that's a reasonable figure to use.
All right. Now that's an important point, because there's a big difference if somebody puts everything in CDs, or if they put everything in the stock market, or if they do something in between. And I know that you have different safe withdrawal recommendations for different years, but why don't we just start with the base and talk about the 30-year rate? So,
okay.
If I put it all in CDs, then inflation and taxes is going to eat me alive, and I'm likely to run out of money. Is that right? In which case, 4.5% might be too high.
That's correct, particularly in today's environment where our interest rates are artificially low and may remain that way for a long time. CDs are going to be devastating for people.
So what you're really saying is it's not necessarily safe to have a high percentage of your portfolios in CDs and fixed income if you want to have a higher safe withdrawal rate.
That's right. In fact, what I found out, it's dangerous to have a very high percentage of fixed income in your portfolio, and it's equally dangerous to have a high percentage of stocks in your portfolio. You need to have a blend somewhere in between for safety.
All right. And if we say that the goal was just to never run out of money for a 30-year period, mm-hmm. what does your research indicate the appropriate blend is?
I think somewhere between 50% and 55%, whatever, equities, risk assets, whatever you want to call it, and the rest in fixed income. So it might be 55% stocks, 45% bonds, and money market funds would be a reasonable allocation to have.
All right. Well, this is very helpful. Let me ask you another question. The famous article that you wrote, and I don't know how many accolades you got from it, but I mean, I thought it was terrific, and I think that, and I have seen it, particularly when I was doing the research to find you again. You know, just a lot of references to that article. So obviously, it was probably the most important article in its day. And I'm not sure that there's a lot else that is written. But that was before 2008, and even your book is before 2008.
That's correct.
All right. Well, you're a bright guy. You're still in practice. Has your opinion changed, and did the downturn make you think, oh, geez, that's maybe I was going a little high, or were you vindicated because other people who were saying higher with safe withdrawal rates, their clients were running out of money and yours were okay?
Well, I think the 4.5% withdrawal rate has stood the test of time. Since I introduced that, you know, in 93 as 4% and raised it a few years later, 4.5%. And I think in this environment, you wouldn't want to do any more. I think it would be extremely dangerous. In fact, I'm not even sure if that is going to, quite frankly, you know, stand up if these market conditions and low interest rates continue, you know, for many more years. We'll have to see.
All right. Now, let's take a simple number, which is $1 million, because that's a nice, easy number to remember. Mm-hmm. And let's assume for discussion's sake that we're going to go by 4.5%. So let's say that you retire on year one and you can take out $45,000. How much money can you take out on year two? Can you take out $45,000, or can you take out more because there is inflation?
Oh, you're exactly right. You want to take inflation.
I can't be right if I didn't give you the answer.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
That's quite all right. Inflation needs to be taken into account. It's crucial that you do that. What happens is the first year you apply the 4.5% and come up with that $45,000 figure. But after the first year, you throw away that 4.5% and never worry about it again. What you do is you take an inflation number. Let's say inflation was 10% for the next year. Well, then you increase your withdrawals by 10%. So instead of $45,000, you're taking out maybe $49,500 the next year. And you just simply do the same each year, just like Social Security. You give yourself a cost of living increase each year with inflation.
All right, and that is calculated into that 4.5% rate. So you actually might end up taking more than 4.5% because it's 4.5% of the base year.
That's correct. If your portfolio is growing slowly, as it probably is, recently, you can actually see your withdrawal rate increase over time. Normally, there are fluctuations during retirement. It could go anywhere. It could go down. It can go up. If you're really unlucky and you retire, let's say, 1966, which is a terrible time to retire because you had this huge market decline and high inflation, it's possible, your money would have lasted exactly 30 years and run out with your dying breath, and you would have been, taking out very high percentages, toward the end of your life. But the percentage will fluctuate from year to year. That's why I say don't worry about the percentage after the first year.
All right. So in effect, it's whatever you took out the first year plus inflation.
That's right. Yeah, it's a simple rule.
All right. Well, that is pretty simple, but I'm kind of a conservative guy, and particularly when it comes to clients running out of money. So let's take two examples. One, a guy comes to you in early 2008, he has $1 million, and you say, okay, you can take out, 4.5%. So he takes out $45,000, and let's say using your pattern, he continues that, taking out $45,000 plus inflation. All right, now, 6 months later, and let's just say it's roughly half bonds and half stocks, the stock portfolio of his the stock portion of his portfolio goes down by, say, 40%. So now his whole portfolio is down 20%. Are you going to go back and readjust every year, or are you going to say, hey, that was already built in with our initial value of 4.5%?
That's a judgment call. And I think it depends upon how my opinion, in my practice, I look at how the client views that. If the client is nervous about the situation, I would certainly recommend that they cut back their withdrawals, even if the rules say we're okay. Because no one really knows what's going to happen in the future. In the past, markets have made, big declines and have been followed by very big recoveries, so that people were able to keep that 4.5% through because eventually their portfolios regained value. But no one knows for sure what's going to happen in the future. So if a client really feels uncomfortable, there's no reason they have to feel trapped in a box. Just reduce withdrawals temporarily or permanently to bring them to their comfort level so they can sleep at night.
Well, I guess my question is, are we safe just taking the number that we spent last year and continuing that on for inflation, or is it really safe to say, hey, I'm going to reevaluate each year, and if it is, let's say, better to reevaluate each year, could we possibly come up to a conclusion that it's more than 4.5%, because if we are reevaluating, then perhaps we don't have the danger of spending too much?
You could reevaluate every year. I think you're probably better off doing it on a longer time frame, maybe 3 to 5 years. Otherwise, you could get whipsawed by market fluctuations, But I think it does make sense to look at your withdrawal plan every so often and maybe make a mid-course correction like you're suggesting, saying, well, you know, we're doing extremely well with our investments. Let's take more out than we had intended because it looks like we're going to be okay. Or conversely, say, you know, portfolio is doing terribly. Let's cut back, you know.
All right. Well, I'm by the way, I'm finding this very helpful. And for whatever it's worth, when I do financial reviews with clients, one of the most important things I do is I look to see how much I think they can safely spend. And interestingly enough, you actually have a chart in your book talking about the different spending withdrawal rates based on different life expectancy rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to be using that exact same source. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that independently we came to what we thought was the right source. Unless, by the way, the people who I use didn't give you credit, unless you're the one who came up with it, and I'm just following what somebody said that you said. But anyway, a lot of people say, well, that's great if you have a 30-year life expectancy, but, you know, these days you have a lot of people who are a little bit nervous, or maybe they just like to work. I was with a physician today, and he just loves working, and I have a lot of college professors as clients, and a lot of those guys keep working, you know, well into their 70s and sometimes 80s, and I have a lot of engineers who, if conditions allow, they like going to work, and they work longer, so that rather than retiring at 60 or even 65, when using maybe a 30-year life expectancy would be reasonable, they're retiring at maybe 75 or 80. And let's say in that case, if you're going to restrict an 80-year-old, and let's assume that they're married and that their spouse is their same age, if you're going to restrict an 80-year-old to a 4.5% withdrawal rate, you're really, I think, potentially restricting what they could safely spend. So what you have done is you have calculated different withdrawal rates for different life expectancies. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about how that works, why you did that, and if those results have been vindicated over time.
Yeah, it's an excellent point you make. Persons who have shorter life expectancies can be more aggressive in their withdrawals. Because it's less likely that a major stock market downturn is going to affect them. If they're looking to withdraw over 30 years, they've got to be very careful. But if it's only 10 or 15 years, well, my table indicates that a person with a 15-year life expectancy could go over 6%.
And by the way, for whatever it's worth, I have your book in front of me, and you actually have 6.3%.
Mm-hmm.
With a total equity allocation of 30%.
That's right. You want to get more conservative with that as you age,
and then
or have a shorter expectancy.
And then for a 10-year life expectancy, and by the way, for listeners, there are sometimes some great times to take notes. This is one of them. Because I'm actually going to go through from 10 to 30 years, because I think that this is such valuable information. For 10 years, You and the way you call it is peak safe max, with a total equity allocation of 40%. You say people could spend up to 8.9% of their portfolio.
That's right.
All right, and that still hasn't changed. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's as valid as the 4.5% is.
Okay.
For the 30-year.
All right, and then for 15 years, you come up with 6.3%,
mm-hmm.
with a 30% allocation. For a 20-year period, you come up with 5.2%. And that's with a 30% allocation in stocks. With a 25-year life expectancy, you're at 4.7% with a 45% allocation in stocks. For 30 years, you're actually at 4.4%, which is, you know, pretty close to what you said before, which is 4.5%,
mm-hmm.
and you say a 50% allocation. So I think that is very helpful, and I use that table. I will tell you, I use that table, if not every day, at least pretty close to it. And I think it's just so important, because we have a lot of older clients, and they have, whether you call it depression era mentality, or the unwillingness to spend a lot of money, they are concerned about running out of money, and many times they are spending well less than their safe withdrawal rates. And one of the reasons, one of the things that I do is I try to show them, hey, you might be able to spend a little bit more money, not that they necessarily do, but using that safe withdrawal rate. So I think that that is very, very valuable.
Great.
We're going to take a quick break right now. We are here with Bill Bengen, and he is the author of Conserving Client Portfolios During Retirement. We're talking about safe withdrawal rates. And as a quick reminder, we are live, so if you have a question or a comment for Bill or Jim, please give us a call, 412-333-9385. You're listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. This is Nicole DiMartino, and this evening I'm here, of course, with Jim Lang, and our guest tonight calling in from California is Bill Bengen. He is the author of Conserving Client Portfolios During Retirement, and we're talking safe withdrawal rates. Before we get back to it, I do see that we have a question, though, all the way from Washington State on the West Coast.
All right, and by the way, I will remind our listeners that we probably have as many, or I think we this year we have had more questions from out of state than in state, and that is because KQV streams, and we have listeners all over the country, and they listen on the internet. And it, by the way, even if you're local, sometimes the signal is a tiny bit muffled, maybe sometimes more than a tiny bit, and you might be better off listening at KQV.com. But anyway, why don't we take the caller from Washington,
Carl?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Alrighty. What's your question for Jim and Bill?
Oh, I'm enjoying the show.
Oh, good.
I wonder if Bill could please comment on the effect of mutual fund and advisor fees on the safe withdrawal rate. And I'll take my answer off the air.
As far as mutual funds go, in my research, I assume that the investor was using index funds, which had extremely low fees, so that the mutual fund fees didn't enter in to my calculation withdrawal rates. They weren't affected by it. With respect to advisor, I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
As far as advisor fees, that should be built into the client's budget for retirement as an expense and should not be forgotten, because I don't think the advisor wants to go unpaid necessarily if they're giving sound advice. So definitely you want to make sure the client has included those fees in their budget and is part of that 4.5% withdrawal.
All right. And for whatever it's worth, some of the money managers that I work with, and I guess I have to be careful about what I'm going to say, but I would say that it would be their hope that their performance would cover the fees. But all right, why don't we go to the in other words, that you could 0.5% because they would be, their hope would be that their performance would be 4.5% or better, or the market or better after their fee. But
that's right, and you have to remember the 4.5% is how much you're withdrawing. People also have other sources of income during retirement, Social Security, pension plans, and so forth, you know, which can be used to pay expenses. So you have to look at the broader picture as well.
All right. Well, let's get into the nitty gritty a little bit, Bill, because you cover this. And by the way, I'm so glad to have you on, because, and I don't want to mention the names of certain books because I don't want to say anything bad about anybody, but I will just tell you that there's a whole bunch of books out there on the safe withdrawal rate, and they have not done the research that Bill has done, and they don't have the depth of insight, and you know they didn't have the education and frankly the quantitative skills that Bill brings to the table. So let's use some of those quantitative skills, Bill. Let's distinguish between an all IRA portfolio. I have a lot of clients that have mainly IRAs. So, for example, college professors, engineers, mid-level managers, people who had you know, let's say they started out with their careers 30, 40 years ago. Maybe they were married, and they and their spouse were pretty much broke at the time. And, you know, they bought a house on credit, so they had a house payment. And then they had kids, and then they had braces expenses, and then they had college expenses, and then they had the car payments and everything else. And it was very hard for them to accumulate a lot of money, but they were pretty prudent souls, and they put money into their retirement plan, and the university or their company or Westinghouse or wherever they worked also put in a portion. So now, let's say that they are at or near retirement, and maybe they have $1 million or $2 million or a little less or a little bit more. But virtually all that money is in an IRA or a 401k or a 403b or a SEP or a KEO. Or what is important about that money is that they have not yet paid tax on it. So how would you advise somebody that instead of having $1 million of what I would call after-tax dollars, money that they have already paid tax on, how would you change the advice if they had $1 million in the IRA?
Okay, fair question. Actually, my research, that 4.5% figure, is intended to apply to tax-deferred accounts like IRAs. If you're examining a taxable account, the withdrawals would actually be about 10% less than that.
Wait. All right. Well, hang on a second. Let's make sure that we understand this. So let's again use $1 million because it's a nice, easy number.
Okay.
All right. So somebody can take out $45,000, but if the source of the money was all IRA, that $45,000 is going to be taxable. And let's say for discussion's sake, to keep it simple, the tax on that is say $10,000. So they have $35,000 left. Can they spend $35,000 or can they spend $45,000 and take out more and pay taxes on that?
The total that would be available to them for withdrawal during that year would be $45,000, and they must not forget the fact that they have to pay taxes. The taxes should be considered as a budgeted expense for them, just like the advisor fees.
Okay.
So they're netting out $35,000 they'll have left for discretionary expenses that year.
Right. And by the way, that's the way I do it, too, is I tell people, okay, you know, if we're going to use 4% or if they're older, you know, a higher percentage, that's fine, but you're going to have to pay taxes from that money.
Correct.
All right. Now, what if that money was outside the IRA? Couldn't you just say, well, then there isn't any taxes, so they could spend the whole $45,000? Or why did you say that you could take out 10% less?
The reason is that the taxable portfolio is soon to be paying taxes on all of its investment gains over time. So it's going to grow at a slower rate than the IRA account. So if you have a taxable account, you had capital gains, you sold something, or else you had dividends, and you paid income taxes on those as you went. Therefore, the taxable account is smaller, but because, let's say, you take out 4% instead of 4.5%, roughly, you can only take out $40,000, but then that money you can spend freely without any further taxes because taxes have already been paid over the years on that.
All right, so your rule of thumb then is take whatever number that you had before, which was, let's say, 4.5% or the higher numbers when we were talking about a reduced life expectancy, and then subtract 10% of that, and then you could spend that money. Is that right?
You were drawing from a taxable account, that's right.
Right, all right. But by the way, it's great when you get a tough question, by the way, and instead of getting mumbo-jumbo, you get a great answer. That you don't often get that with a lot of, well, I better watch myself here. all righty. Now, let's assume for discussion's sake that somebody has a pension plan. And let's just say for discussion's sake, it's $5,000 a month. All right. But what is unique about it is that, or it's not so unique anymore, it's kind of standard, is the amount of the pension is fixed. In other words, it's not going to be like our legislators that get a nice raise every time there's inflation or every time they have a bill, but rather than it is, let's say, $60,000 a year, and maybe it's $60,000 today, and maybe if they live 30 years, it's still $60,000. But if inflation is at 3%, maybe that $60,000 is only worth $15,000. All right, so we have, let's call it, an ever-decreasing purchasing power from their pension. And by the way, I would say the same thing with Social Security. The theoretically, Social Security may have some cost of living increase. How would you then recommend somebody handle the safe withdrawal issue in that case? And by the way, if you can get this one, that's really good, because I don't know the answer.
That's a question I've explored in great detail. It's a very important point, because many people find themselves in that situation where they have a fixed pension and they've got a sum of money in addition that they're withdrawing from. And the answer is that the 4.5% rate almost certainly is going to have to be decreased substantially, and you almost have to go through the calculations using software to do it. The reason is that each year you can take out from your portfolio and give yourself a cost of living adjustment, but you're not going to get that out of your pension plan. So if your overall spending is going to go up with inflation, your portfolio now has to do double duty. It has to give itself a cost of living increase, and it now also give you the money you're drawing from your pension plan a cost of living increase. So that as a result, I've done calculations for clients where instead of 4.5% the first year, they had to take out 3.5% or 3% or even 2.8% so that their money would last. And that's all because they've got to be, the greatest enemy, you know, during a retiree is inflation. They have to make provisions for that. And the pension plan is kind of like an anchor, you know, during retirement, because it doesn't do anything with respect to inflation for you.
Oh, Bill, you're killing me. I thought you were going to give me an easy answer, because I've always said, well, I've kind of included a fudge factor, if you will, and lowered it.
Okay.
All right, so now you're telling me that my instinct is right. The idea of using a fudge factor is accurate. Now you're telling me what I sometimes tell people when I go around the country doing Roth IRA conversion workshops, and they say, and I say, you know, to determine the optimal amount of the Roth IRA conversion, you actually have to run the numbers and you have to run the projections, and we have a combination of Roth IRA conversion software, by the way, also 1040 software, which we think is intricate to the calculation, and then we interpolate and work back and forth. And the truth is, there is no easy one quick answer. So you said you have to use the software, and I know we have a lot of financial advisors. Is there a particular program that you can recommend? Because I would love to know how to do that.
Sure, I use, there are several excellent financial planning software packages on the market. I happen to use MoneyGuide Pro because it's web-based, so I can share it with my clients. When I prepare a plan for them, they can see the plan on their own home computer.
Is that available free for our listeners, or is that a financial?
That's something, no, unfortunately you have to pay an annual fee for.
Okay.
It's pretty significant, you know.
All right. And out of curiosity, because I know we have a lot of financial advisors listening, how much is that a year? Roughly?
I think I'm paying somewhere in the range of $1,100 a year for that.
All right. Well, that doesn't sound too bad to me, because I will tell, and I assume it does other things too, but I will tell you that to me is a really tough issue. And the other thing that I don't know how to do, and I don't know if there's any software in the world that could tell us this, is how to do that calculation if somebody doesn't have a pension, but if somebody has Social Security. In other words, can we count on a cost of living raise for Social Security? I don't think we can, but I don't have any, you know, excellent substantive reasoning or sources that would say that.
In other words, if you have doubts about the future cost of living adjustments from Social Security?
Right.
That is really, you know, that depends upon your interpretation of what's going
to
happen.
All right, so that has to be a true fudge factor.
Yeah,
there's no. All right, now what about this? By the way, I love when there's quantitative people that can answer questions, because a lot of times I have engineers and other quantitative types, and they come in and they ask all the questions that they're not used to getting an answer for, and then when they get an answer, they're pretty surprised. So I like this, and you're doing great. You really are.
Thank you.
I appreciate this, Bill. All right, so what do you do now if you have a one-life pension? So you have somebody who is married, and for some reason or another, they either didn't do a two-life pension, which is what I typically recommend, or in some variations, although not the ones I found, by the way. I find that it usually is cheaper to take a two-life pension. If you do a one-life pension, then you do a life insurance policy to cover the surviving spouse in the event that the person who took the pension dies. So that's why my starting assumption is two-life. But a lot of times people come to me after that decision has been made. So they might come to me with a one-life pension and no life insurance. How would you cover that possibility?
That's something where you're going to have to go to the software again and run the numbers on it. There's no simple answer to that. Depends upon, you know, how long they expect to live, and I think you want to look at different contingencies. If they, you know, they die a lot sooner than they thought they would, they may want to be more conservative with the withdrawals to account for that. You know, that's a complex issue.
Yeah, because see, this is what happens in real life. It's, you know, I'd love to say, okay, you have $1 million, you know, you're gonna, you tell me your mom lived till 80, but you're feeling pretty healthy, and you want to say, what I always do, I don't know what you do, is I always add some years to what my clients tell me. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I say, well, how long do you think you're going to live? And, you know, there's a couple jokes, and then they start telling me about, well, you know, my mom, you know, died when she was, you know, 82, and my dad died when he was 77, but he used to smoke cigarettes, but, you know, he died of heart failure that now could easily be corrected, or something like that. But what I will typically do is whatever they tell me, I typically add a few years, because I think that the idea here is to be conservative, not to be aggressive, because I don't want to say, oops, I guess we miscalculated. I'm really sorry that you're 87 years old and you don't have any money.
Yeah, I really endorse I really endorse what you're saying there. You know, when I run those MoneyGuide Pro projections for my clients the first time, I take them out to age 105, and I usually get giggles from people because they can't envision themselves living to 105. But I've been in practice over 20 years, and I had four clients with me who were in their mid-70s when I started, and they're in their mid-90s in good health and good mind, and they could easily live to 105. And they're very glad that we took the planning out that far. So I think it's good to have a margin of error in these matters.
All right.
All right. We're going to take one last break. You are listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. We are here. We have about 12 minutes left in the show. Jim, I think you were writing some things down. You have a couple more questions for Bill.
Oh, yeah. I could go on for hours, but I don't know.
Bill, aren't you glad this is just an hour?
I'm enjoying this enormously.
Good.
Well, thanks. You're giving us some great information. And frankly, I'm throwing out some of the toughest questions that I come across. There is another factor that I want to know if you take into account in your practice, which I do in mine. Let's assume for discussion's sake that your analysis is exactly right. You know, the market goes down at the worst time, you calculated it out, the client lives exactly as long as you had thought, he spends his last dollar and dies, so you got it perfect. But now they have a $500,000 house. Let's say the client said, hey, I love my kids, and you know, whatever I can do to help my kids out when I'm gone, that's great. And if I make a Roth IRA conversion, as long as it's not costing me purchasing power, if my kids can be a couple hundred thousand dollars or more better off, that's great. But I died with an extra $500,000 that I never spent. It seems to me that maybe I could have got a reverse mortgage on it. Maybe at some point I could have sold it. So going into that 30-year period, let's assume that you have a paid-up house, and let's just use $500,000 because it's a nice, easy number. Can you take into account the equity of your home in determining how much money you can spend?
Theoretically, I guess you could. I haven't explored that. It depends upon, you know, the willingness of the client to consider that concept. Some people don't want to, you know, touch the equity in their home. Others want to be more aggressive with it. I think it's a matter of the client's preference, you know, in that regard.
Well, I would say most clients would prefer not to, but I'll quote Jonathan Clemons on this, because Jonathan Clemons of the Wall Street, or formerly of the Wall Street Journal, he's no longer there, but he and I did a column on this issue, and what he said, Bill, is that you could take 60% of the equity in your home and consider that as part of the base of the safe withdrawal rate, on the theory that if it ever came down to it, you could either mortgage your home, get a reverse mortgage, and I like the concept of a reverse mortgage. I might not like the fees, but I like the concept of it, where you, in effect, can spend some of the equity in your home. Or, for that matter, if it really came down to it, you could sell it. So what Jonathan says is, but he says, hey, you can't take 100% because the value of the home could go down, or you might have to pay some fees, etc. I would say that a lot of clients might not feel comfortable with it. The way I do it is I present it, and then I let the client decide themselves. On the other hand, I'll give you an example of one case where it worked out really well. I had a client, and they had most of their money in their IRA, and they basically needed, you know, the full safe withdrawal rate from their IRA. And their particular, they happened to be Orthodox Jews, and their most important thing for them during their lifetime was that their grandchildren be educated at the yeshiva. And even though the tuition wasn't terribly expensive, there was tuition. And what their plan for that was to cash in more of their IRA, pay the income taxes on it, and get the net of that, and use that to pay for their grandchildren's tuition. And I hated the idea that they were prematurely taxing their IRA, taking out more than they really should. So we actually ended up doing, you know, I'm kind of a cheapskate, so rather than doing a traditional reverse mortgage, and that might be a very good solution for a lot of people, but what we ended up doing is we basically did a series of home equity borrowings to pay that tuition. Now, yes, they will likely, almost inevitably, die in debt. But what will happen is, in their case, it was a condominium. The condominium will likely be sold after they're both gone, and then the proceeds can pay off the mortgage, and anything left over can go to their children or grandchildren. But in the meantime, they had that additional money that they could use. Now, they happen to choose to spend it to pay for tuition for yeshiva. Other people obviously will have different uses for the money. But I don't know if you consider that a legitimate way of doing things or not.
I think that's an intriguing and clever idea. In Southern California, of course, we have no home equity left. No one in Southern California, no, I'm just kidding, but there are a tremendous number of foreclosures here. I think it's a concept that's worth looking at. I mean, you have that value. I think what I do in my practice, I tell my clients, look, we've made these assumptions, a lot of assumptions, okay? In case we're wrong, you live a lot longer or the market's a lot worse, you have your home here as a last resort, and we could do some of the things you've been talking about. You know, so we kind of like keep the home in reserve. But I don't see why you couldn't do explicit calculations with it like you're suggesting. I think that's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, the way I kind of use it is, I guess it's a little bit of a reserve, but also sometimes not being afraid of doing it. And by the way, on that particular issue, Jonathan Clemons and I came to the conclusion that doing a kind of a running and ever increasing home equity loan made more sense than doing a reverse mortgage. Now, obviously, a lot of the mortgage brokers are screaming bloody murder right now, and I'm sure that in many cases a traditional reverse mortgage would work. My problem, by the way, with a traditional mortgage, so let's say somebody says, okay, my house is worth $500,000. Let's assume that the bank would give them a traditional mortgage of, say, $300,000. My issue then is they don't need the $300,000 today, and then if they invest it hoping to do well, to me that's kind of like an arbitrage situation where you borrow, admittedly at today's low rates, which are as low as I've ever seen them, you borrow the money and you hope to do better in your investments. To me, that's a little bit too risky.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I would concur with your take on that.
All righty. Now let's get into this. This is an area where your book and I have given different advice. And so we'll get to this. Now, this is what I hear a lot. So let's say that people retire, they're 65 years old, and they are, let's assume, in both in good health, and they say, hey, you know something, I look at my parents, and my parents, you know, after they reached their mid-80s or even earlier, they had a real hard time getting around. You know, Dad got sick, and Mom had to spend a lot of time taking care of them. And even if they wanted to spend more money, they really couldn't because they were just too old to travel. I'm feeling pretty good right now. I'm healthy. Europe beckons. I want to go to the islands. I want to have some fun while I'm still healthy, and I can still do that. Can I take out a little bit more? And I, you know, again, that was one of those fudge factors that I never knew exactly how to quantify, but that seemed to me a little bit okay. And then I read your book, and you say, no, 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 you can't do that. So why don't you kill some of the vacation dreams of some of our listeners and talk about whether you think it's legitimate to have a fudge factor for taking out a little bit more early, or whether that is not a responsible thing to do.
I'm going to have to read my book again. I didn't know I said no.
Well, you didn't say no, but specifically what you said was, You it's great quoting you to you, isn't it? you said there were basically three phases of retirement. Let's call it the young, healthy phase, and then the last phase, which is, you know, older, maybe nursing home or personal care, et cetera, and then the one in between. And then you quoted a classic study, and then you kind of amended it. But I believe you came to the conclusion that because sometimes you had to consider long-term care or additional expenses in the last stage, you couldn't really live it up in the first of those three stages.
I think you have to be really careful about what you do in the early years of retirement, because they set the pattern for the latter stages of retirement. And if you consume too much capital early in retirement, you may have to live as a pauper later on. You know, particularly if the market, you know, turns down on you. The early years of retirement, the compounding, as you know, in the early years of any investment cycle are the most important, because that money will compound for the longest. So if you take that early money and use it early, may have to cut back a lot more than you expected. In other words, you might have to go from, you know, go to 5.5%. Say, I'm going to spend 5.5%. After 10 years, you may have to cut back to 3.5 or something really drastic, and you have to decide whether you can actually make that kind of a lifestyle change. And some people can, and that's fine.
I'll bet all the travel agents and hotels are wincing right now. They don't want to hear this. But I think is your point that you said in your book that it was your experience that a lot of your older clients weren't able to had higher expenses. By the way, you have about 30 seconds to answer.
Sure.
So if you could do that,
that's
I would appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah. Generally, you'd be surprised at how some people think expenses will drop later in retirement because of lack of travel. Not true. You have increased medical expenses, living expenses, perhaps you're moving into retirement community. Maybe you want to be gifting to your children. That should be considered an expense. Don't assume that your expenses later in life are going to drop off a cliff. It'll be much higher than you think.
Alrighty, Bill, we're going to close the show now. Thank you so much. Jim's smiling here. I know he's had a good time this evening. We hope you did too. Thank you for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at RetireSecure.com. To seek Jim's advice personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.